Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hello, I'm Richard Ady. Welcome to Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Glad you could join me. The Prime Minister's called homelessness a national shame. So what's going to be done about it? You'll hear about that shortly. Also, forget Sydney versus Melbourne. Every city in the country is competing for you. And so are quite a few not even in Australia. That's later. Right. Let's crack on. Have you heard about Second Life? It's an internet-based virtual world which enables people in completely different parts of the world to interact with one another. You do this through avatars, a sort of 3D representation of yourself. Unsurprisingly, nearly everyone's avatar is better looking than they are. All sorts of organisations are getting on Second Life. I think the ABC's there somewhere. But until now, none of the sandstone universities. Well, the University of Queensland's taking the plunge. It's bought space, it's building an island, actually, and one of the key people behind this is Helen Farley, a lecturer in religious studies. Hello, Helen.
Hi, Richard.
How's this going to work? You're going to have an island and teach religious studies?
We are. We're going to build a series of religious spaces, so we'll be building a church and a synagogue, some unusual spaces too, such as a Freemasons' temple. And we're going to take students in there to role play and recreate rituals and learn about religions firsthand.
Why is your subject the first to get into this space?
Gosh, I'm not sure. Religion has been in Second Life just about from the beginning. Religions in general have been very quick to spot the potential. So I guess it's just a continuation of that.
Right. And it's all about this immersive experience, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. That's something we first used to think about in terms of language studies. Obviously, if you want to learn French, the best place to go to is France and totally immerse yourself in it. You're going to learn it much faster. And that's what we're planning to do.
It's not a substitute for actually going to France, though, is it? I mean, it's like a kind of cheaper version of going to France.
Well, I don't know about you, Richard, but I don't get overseas nearly as often as I would like. So a substitute is better than nothing.
And you're without the food, sadly. Now, your island on Second Life cost, I think, $10,000 for a 5-year lease.
That's right.
What do you get for that?
Well, you get an island about 256 metres by 256 metres. You get to terraform it, it's called, like make the landscape exactly how you would like it. So we're going to have some forest and some mountains. And you get to use the servers which host the island, and then everyone can have access to it.
Some of the very top universities, including places like Princeton and Harvard, have bought land on Second Life. How are they using what are they doing there?
Oh, they're doing all sorts of really interesting things. For example, Harvard actually teaches law in Second Life. There's a course called Cyber One, Law in the Court of Public Opinion, that's conducted entirely in Second Life. So students meet up instead of meeting up in a classroom. They meet up in a space in Second Life. They can talk to each other, interact, and then do moots and things right there in Second Life.
So it's like being in a almost like a courtroom, only without the same kind of level of stress, I suppose.
And without the same sort of level of expense either.
And Princeton, or you already mentioned Princeton, I understand that also another uni basically runs a sort of closed ecosystem with where they can, conduct experiments?
Well, what happens is that they've created these cyber plants, I guess you'd call them, and cyber animals, and they have weather simulations. And so it runs like a closed ecosystem. There's no external input at all. And so if you go back there after being there before, it'll be totally different, just dependent on what's happening within that ecosystem.
What about med students? Because it seems to me this is an obvious way of using this interface, if you like, for medical students?
It's used a lot by universities teaching medicine, and they're using it in a few different ways. I mean, obviously, It's a great environment for learning how to interview people and take medical histories and those sorts of things. But also it goes beyond that as well, where people can actually go in and try and make diagnoses and treat people and see how they respond to those treatments. And there's some quite sophisticated simulations. UC Davis Medical School is doing that.
That's in California.
That's right.
On Life Matters today, my guest is Dr. Helen Farley, who's a lecturer in religious studies at the University of Queensland, which is the first of our sandstone universities to take the plunge into Second Life. If you're not familiar with Second Life, it's this internet-based virtual world. So Helen's really being a pioneer as far as universities are in Australia. Now, I mentioned your area's religion. There's been some fuss about religion in Second Life. I've been reading about an Anglican minister called Mark Brown.
That's right. He actually conducts real-life sermons in Second Life. So any Sunday you can go to his cathedral on Epiphany Island and listen to Mark deliver a sermon. And it's fantastic. He goes around and talks to everyone afterwards to kind of find out why they're there, what they're doing, what they're getting from this. And what he's found is that people come along to these sermons who can't get to church in real life for whatever reason. They may be old, they may be disabled. He has one person who comes along who actually has Tourette's syndrome. So obviously that would make it very difficult for that person to go to a normal service.
What do the church authorities think about this?
Well, it's interesting. The Anglican Church is looking upon it fairly favourably. At the moment, they're trying to decide whether the communion that Mark gives in Second Life is real or not, and Mark seems to think that they will decide in his favour, that it will be considered valid and real.
All right, so you're in the process of building on your island this a mosque, and I think you said a Hindu temple and a Christian church and a Freemason's lodge.
Yes.
What will happen next?
What will happen next is I'll start taking students in there. What will happen is that they'll be going in to recreate rituals or to do some role-playing and those sorts of things, so to fully immerse themselves in the experience. I mean, I can stand up in front of a class and I can talk about Hindu ritual. I can show some photos. I might even be able to show them a short film about it. But it's not the same as being there and playing different roles within that ritual and learning about it that way. There's no comparison.
Aren't you going to need to have the cooperation of the different faiths to do this properly so that they can be, I suppose, not licensed, but actually very authentic in how it's presented?
Well, certainly we've been putting a lot of time into researching how these things go on. You've got to keep in mind that they're not actual religious rituals, and we wouldn't presume to do that. It's certainly no substitute us doing them for the real thing, but we can approximate them as closely as is possible.
And you'd still, I would imagine, encourage the students, or at least their avatars, to be respectful while they're in those places.
Yes, absolutely. And that will be a definite requirement. For instance, women won't be able to go into the mosque, or female avatars won't be able to go into the mosque without wearing a headscarf, or they'll have to take off their shoes, those sorts of things.
Apart from being able to take part in this from anywhere with a broadband connection, what are the advantages of teaching through Second Life?
Well, immersion is the main benefit. Being able to fully participate in something, to fully be surrounded by something, as I've said, that's a far more authentic experience than sitting in a classroom. I also have postgraduate students. For example, I have one that lives in Melbourne, and she feels very isolated and alone being away from the university and being away from me as her supervisor. And we meet up in Second Life to try and overcome some of those problems. Just yesterday afternoon, I gathered my postgraduate students that are here in Queensland, and we met up with my postgraduate student in Melbourne so she could have the full benefits of being in a community and in a research community. So there are those sorts of benefits as well, and I don't think they can be underestimated.
Well, yeah, but they shouldn't be overestimated either, should they? I mean, you said have the full benefits, but it can't be exactly the same as all being in the same physical space.
No, that's right. It's not exactly the same, but there are certain advantages as well. My student in Melbourne can show me spaces relevant in Second Life which pertain to her research, those sorts of things. And she can also meet up with people who are interested in her topic. She's researching paganism, so she can meet up with other pagans in Second Life. So in some ways it's not so good, but in some ways it's better.
Now, before I let you go, Helen, I have to ask, your avatar, is your avatar better looking than you?
Well, that's a bit difficult to say because my avatar is a guy.
Do you know, I saw a picture and I thought, that avatar of Helen's has got very broad shoulders. I actually
he
did
has.
Think that.
And he's 7 foot two.
Right, okay. All right, well, so I have no clue at all as to whether you're really 7 foot two or not. I'm going to guess you're not. Helen, thank you very much. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Richard.
Dr. Helen Farley is a lecturer in religious studies at the University of Queensland and a pioneer into the virtual world, Second Life, not just at uni, but any of the sandstones. And look, later this week on Life Matters, Susan Mousart brings us her rather confronting adventures in Second Life. This is Life Matters, as I just mentioned, on ABC Radio National. And coming up, why Adelaide, where I'm coming to you today from, wants you, and Brisbane, and Perth, even Singapore. But next, the great Australian dream becomes the great Australian shame.
Hello, I'm Michael McKenzie, and on Bush Telegraph, the next frontier for GM technology. Engineering grass so that cows give more milk with less water, and the milk could be allergy-free. The dairy industry seems onside, and while it's only a trial stage, are there dangers for the integrity of our food supply? Bush Telegraph this morning after the news at 11 on ABC Radio National.
The Prime Minister says it's a national shame. I'm talking about the 100,000 Australians who are homeless each night. Kevin Rudd has placed the issue firmly on the national agenda, promising a 10-year effort to improve the situation. And this week in Adelaide, strategies for making a difference are under discussion at the 5th National Homelessness Conference. Simon Smith is the Executive Officer of Homelessness Australia, and he's with me now in our Adelaide studio. Welcome to Life Matters.
Good morning, Richard. Thanks for having me on the show.
Who are Australia's homeless?
I think it's really interesting when we talk about Australia's homeless to think about who is the stereotypical homeless person and then compare it to what we know. The stereotypical homeless person, even today, to most people, according to research that's been done, is a middle-aged man who sleeps on a park bench. But what we know when we look at the research and what we know from the census not count of the homeless in Australia each year is that there are many different types of homelessness. So while we have this stereotypical image in our mind, about half of all homeless people in Australia are under 25, about 10,000 are under 12.
10,000 are under 12.
That's correct.
I think we have touched on this before, but I still am shocked when I hear that terrible statistic.
It is quite striking when you spell it out like that. 10,000 under 12, about 40% of women.
So where are they? If they're not on park benches, and thank God they're not, where are they?
Sure. Well, there are about 100,000 people from what we can estimate who are homeless each night in Australia. That's based on the count of the homeless each census night. About 15,000 people on that given night sleep rough. About 40,000 are couch surfing, so they're staying on the couches of family and friends. Many stay in caravan parks and boarding houses and other marginal types of accommodation. And about 15,000 on that given night, when we count the homeless, are staying in homeless services.
Often people have, I suppose, very fixed ideas about this. We've already mentioned there's the stereotypical view of a middle-aged man, probably with substance abuse problems, sleeping rough. The other issue, I suppose, is that people think it's an urban issue for our biggest cities. Mm. What's the situation, say, here in South Australia, for example?
Sure. What we know from the census night count is that there are about 7,500 people in South Australia who are homeless, so that's about 50 people per 10,000 head of population. One of the most striking things about the homeless in South Australia that we can glean, not necessarily from the census data, but from the people who use homeless services in Australia, in South Australia, is that about one in every four are children. And about one in every five are Indigenous. So bearing in mind that, as I said before, that only a small proportion of people who are homeless on any given night use homeless services, that still gives you some indication about who is experiencing homelessness in South Australia.
The Prime Minister says tackling homelessness, it's a decade-long effort. Is he right?
I think he's right, and from our perspective, we strongly welcome the commitment by the government to a long-term strategy to address homelessness. The reality is that if we want to design a policy approach that's going to really effectively tackle homelessness, we need to take a longer-term view. There are a range of different things that we'll need to fund, build and implement over the next 10 years to really effectively address homelessness, and we can't put all of these things in place at once. So there are things like more funding for public housing, more of a role for the government in the private rental market to increase affordable housing for people who've experienced homelessness.
More of the community housing that we've talked about before on Life Matters.
Yeah, that's true. And a range of other things too, like the way we administer Centrelink payments, the need for a national domestic violence strategy that it looks at the relationship between homeless amongst women and children that results from domestic violence. And there's some welcome initiatives in the budget that were came out last week. So we look forward to working with the government on the detail of those initiatives.
Now, a green paper was due on this last week, and I think details will be revealed at the conference this week, is that right?
We're still very much hoping that the green paper will be released when the minister comes to our national conference in Adelaide on Thursday and Friday. We, in looking at the FACSIA website, the Department of Families, Community Services, Housing and Indigenous Affairs, the federal department, they're still hoping to have the green paper released this week. So we're hoping that that will happen at the conference.
You're calling for, I suppose, a new response to homelessness. You want a greater consideration for building pathways out of it.
Mm.
That's a lot more than just providing a bed for the night, isn't it?
Absolutely, that's right. To really effectively respond to homelessness, what we need to do is look at the reasons why people became homeless in the first place and work with people who've experienced homelessness and support them to address whatever those reasons are. So in terms of what I said initially, there are many different reasons why people experience homelessness, not just substance abuse. So things like domestic violence, family breakdown, young people running away from home, financial crisis. To build an effective pathway out of homelessness, we need to look at why people became homeless in the first place and give them the support that they need to address whatever those reasons are.
So early intervention, prevention, and also crisis management.
Yeah, sure. Look, there are a range of different things we can do to prevent homelessness from happening in the first place. We know that there are some federal government programs which have been demonstrated to be highly effective. There's a program for families that works with families at risk of homelessness that have been identified through, for example, Centrelink. That program runs from a small number of sites nationally and could be expanded across the country. But at the same time, though, I think in building our new approach to homelessness, we should also recognise that while we can do lots more to prevent homelessness, we're not at that point now where we can identify everyone who's at risk and stop them from being homeless. As you say, Richard, there's still a need for crisis services and there's still a need for thinking about and designing strategies to help people get out of homelessness in the long run too.
If you've just joined us, this is Life Matters on ABC Radio National, and I'm Richard Ady. My guest is Simon Smith, who's the Executive Officer of Homelessness Australia. We're talking about really... Well, there's a conference which kicks off in Adelaide this week, but we're talking about homelessness across Australia. 100,000 Australians are homeless every night. The Prime Minister's called it a national shame. We're talking about what might be done about this. How to engage communities to help prevent and respond to homelessness has got to be on the agenda, hasn't it?
That's right. One of the things that we're hoping to discuss at the National Conference this week is that very notion of how do we engage the broader community. I think the initial thing that we need to do is to look at people's stereotypes and challenge them. Because I think when people realise that homelessness affects so many different people in so many different ways, it naturally wants to, they become engaged in the issue. The thing that you've touched on, Richard, for example, is the fact that 10,000 children under 12 are homeless each night. And that's not something a lot of people appreciate. The other point that I could add to that is that one in every 60 children under five in the whole country use a homeless service each year. That's an astonishing figure, and it sort of indicates a range of broad social issues that underline that. Overwhelmingly, kids under five, for example, would be accompanying their mother who's escaping a situation of domestic violence. So when we start to discuss the reality of homelessness and when we start to unpack how different that is from the stereotype, I think we really start to engage the broader community.
That's the issue for you, because the stereotype is simple and homelessness is actually complex.
Yeah, that's right.
The government's already announced some measures, and I'm thinking of $150 million on new homes over 5 years, I think that from memory.
That's correct.
How helpful will that be?
Look, that's a very welcome first step to addressing homelessness. From our perspective, though, if we're looking ahead over the next 10 years, there's a range of different things that we'll need to do to really address homelessness. So that's a very welcome first step. And as I've mentioned already, there are some other initiatives in the budget that are welcome. There are also lots of other things we need to do as well. I think we can't address an issue like homelessness without really looking at what's happening in the housing market. We need to give more people options in public and community housing. One of the things we could do is to look at the National Rental Affordability Scheme, which is this initiative the government's announced to increase the supply of affordable private rental housing.
20% under the market it'll be.
That's right. And at the moment that scheme's focused on people on low incomes in rental stress. And that we acknowledge that that's an important issue that needs to be addressed. From our perspective, though, we'd be interested to talk to the government about whether or not we could use that scheme to perhaps reserve some of those places for people who've experienced homelessness, to give them other options, other housing options apart from public and community housing. There are a range of different things from our perspective that we'd be looking for over the next 10 years.
Do you feel, though, now that you might be more likely to be pushing at an open door? When the Prime Minister has come out and said, this is a national shame, it can't be ignored anymore, we need to spend a decade getting this right, are you more hopeful about the future?
Oh, look, absolutely we are. That's not to say that we're going to get everything that we need to really effectively respond to homelessness at once. We need to continue to demonstrate that what we're proposing will contribute to a fall in the number of people who are homeless, who experience homelessness in Australia. It's an interesting dynamic that we're entering into with the government. They are committed to addressing this issue, but I expect that we'll continue to have robust discussions as we move forward about what we need in this new approach to homelessness.
Well, good luck with it, Simon, and good luck with the conference as well. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thanks, Richard.
Simon Smith, the Executive Officer of Homelessness Australia, and the 5th National Homelessness Conference begins in Adelaide this week. Wouldn't mind getting your perspective on this, actually. Give us a ring on 02833 1430 and leave a comment, or you can go to our website, abc.net.au/rn/lifematters. Coming up on the show, it's great to feel wanted, isn't it? Why our cities are competing for your skills.
The fantastic sounds of the hunter's harp and the vocals of Malian musician Adama Koulibaly. Tune into the Daily Planet afternoons at 2:20 and evenings at 11:20 to hear the story of Adama Coulibaly and the voice of his musical sponsor, Salif Keita. What a voice. Hope you can join me.
Cities have always been in competition with one another. Before we had countries or nation-states, that's what they're technically known as. Cities were the places that mattered. It wasn't called the Italian Empire, for example. Italy didn't exist until the 19th century, but Rome dominated Europe, North Africa and the Middle East for more than 500 years. Increasingly, cities are competing for people around the world. Rich people, obviously, but smart, well-educated, creative people, most of all. And it's not just the really big places in this competition, London, New York and Tokyo. Increasingly, Boston, Barcelona and Singapore are making inroads. So where does that leave Australian cities? Someone who thinks about this issue from more than one perspective is Dean Forbes, an urban policy researcher and also Deputy Vice-Chancellor at Flinders University here in Adelaide. And he's here with me now. Welcome to Life Matters, Dean.
Thank you, Richard.
Most people probably never think about this. Why is this intense competition going on?
I think the competition has grown with globalisation, really. The more the world economies become integrated, the more cities become competitors to find a niche in that global economy. Initially, the competition was around the major world cities, the New Yorks and Londons and so on. But increasingly, it's gone down the urban hierarchy to the smaller cities, the 1 million population cities and so on. We're all competing in the same economy and seeking to find niches for ourselves, niches that will sustain us into the future.
And the one thing that everybody is after, every city is after, is, as I mentioned when I was introducing this, smart, creative people. What are the prizes for the winners, for the cities that pull this off, if you like?
It's tuned to the kind of city that it is. But I think the prize is that the global economy is shifting. It's becoming more specialised in different parts. And it's the knowledge economy which is becoming increasingly central to all our activities. It doesn't matter whether an economy is based around resources, as of course much of Australia is, or it's based around actual knowledge products. The knowledge economy is central to how we make use of those resources and how we plot our future.
Mm. Yeah, we tend to think of resources as being, and the resources boom's had a huge impact, but allied to that and related to it and coming off at that is that a lot of Australian firms have been world leaders in things like software allied with the resources and mining boom.
That's right. Australia's always had a rural economy, an agricultural economy, now a minerals economy as well, has been going gangbusters. But it's really the services economy that is one of our great strengths in terms of our global positioning. Our corporate sector has tried to build on that. And in the last few years, or the last decade or so, our education sector has also made a huge impact on that kind of knowledge economy and has done extremely well.
Mm, I'm glad we got to that. I mentioned Singapore a minute or so ago. That's a city-state, of course, but it's the city in our region that recently won some recognition. It came top in the most admired knowledge cities index in the world. What are they doing so right there?
Singapore has been very responsive to changes within the global economy, and it has been over the last four decades, really, of its independent existence, partly stimulated by the fact that there's been one party in power for the whole of that time. But essentially, they recognise that they are a services economy. They have got a massive airport, a great port system, but they really needed to build their intellectual capital to attract in foreign talent to the city, to build their education services, to become an education hub, the schoolhouse of the world, but also to use that knowledge that they can create to continue their comparative advantage in those range of other service industries.
They've been very single-minded about this because, unlike Australia, they have no natural resources. They're on some key trade routes, so they've built the port and they are a hub for transportation. But they really had nothing else going for them except human capital. So they were one of the first, in a way, to realise that it was people that were key.
That's right. And they have a great location, of course, as a crossroads, and hence it's a great transport role. But they saw the value of their people. Of course, when they started down their path of economic development, they thought they could grow as a manufacturing hub, which was, of course, crazy in the sense that they were never large enough to be able to do that. But they had the capacity to recalibrate the strategy and adapt it to the changing global circumstances. And they've done it very successfully. And Singapore, as anyone from Australia knows, and we pass through Singapore all the time, of course, when we go overseas, is a vibrant and thriving economy.
What about Australian cities? Because I know Melbourne was actually nominated for the award that Singapore ended up winning.
Yes. Well, I think most of the Australian cities, whether through a very strong strategy or by default, have been building their knowledge economies. And Melbourne, a couple of years ago, decided that its role as a knowledge centre was something that needed to be strategised, not just to occur. Melbourne and Sydney have dominated in terms of the growth of international education as an export industry in Australia. But I think Melbourne sought to take that a lot further and recognise that international education, the ability to attract students, was only one aspect of what the knowledge city could become. Melbourne has great research institutes, some strong universities, and institutions of that kind that combined with that international education role could really drive it forward as a major competitor in terms of the great knowledge cities of the world.
The state government, successive state governments in Victoria have been very proactive in this regard. If we think of other Australian cities, though, and if we start with Sydney, our biggest place, I live there, and I think it's fair to say that there's been either complacency or a lack of urgency or thought about this on the part of successive state governments in New South Wales?
I think that's certainly been the case. And if you listen to the universities, they keep saying that over and over again, that unlike most of the other states, New South Wales has never really, it seems to me, grappled with the idea of or the place of the universities in a modern knowledge economy and the value that you can get out of this.
It's the universities, and obviously you have an interest in this, Dean.
I do.
But are key to the Australian approach on this.
I think universities are central to the development of most modern cities and city regions. But I think in Australia, the universities have played a particular role. And again, I come back to international education. I think Australian universities have really led the world in terms of building that into a major revenue-generating industry, but also an industry that brings a great diversity of people to our cities helps create vibrant central business districts and so on. So I think that the universities have had a more apparent role in Australian cities in terms of this pattern of development than in most other parts of the world. The difficult task is now adding on to that international education all these more nuanced aspects of the knowledge economy, research, innovation, all these other kinds of things.
Perhaps the city that seems to have pulled off the most spectacular transformation in Australia, as a semi-regular visitor, I would think would be Brisbane, which is so different now to even where it was 10 years ago, and it's all around that sort of smart city, huge investment in and around the University of Queensland and also QUT right in the middle of Brisbane.
Brisbane has done very well, yes. And like Perth, it's been one of the boom cities. But it's different to Perth in the sense that I think my impression is that the state government has given considerable resources to the universities, particularly to the two you mentioned, to build their research precincts and so on. And those universities have also been very successful in attracting foundation funds from overseas, some very substantial investments from benefactors overseas, which combined with the state government funding has really had an impact on Brisbane, I think.
On Life Matters today, my guest is Professor Dean Forbes, who's both an urban policy researcher and with his other hat, Deputy Vice-Chancellor at Flinders University here in Adelaide. We are talking about the rather brutal, awfully polite, but still Darwinian competition that's going on between cities. Everybody wants you if you're smart and creative. Dean, what about here in Adelaide? You've got here the festival, you've got the Ideas Festival with the Thinkers in Residence program, it's a defence science hub. It sounds like enough. It sounds like a lot. Is it going to be enough?
I think Adelaide's had a unique role in Australia's history. It's always been a centre of the arts and a centre for education, and I think it's played above its weight, really, or punched above its weight in terms of what it's achieved through its history. Hence the Nobel Prize winners, the Fields Medal winners. You know, some of Australia's great artists have come from Adelaide. But we're, of course, in a different phase of competition now. Adelaide's still focused around the arts, and the Festival of Arts still has that great reputation within the country. But its economy has been flat for a number of years and only now is starting to revive. I was in Sydney Airport on the weekend and I noticed as I was coming out a big advertisement which effectively said, why invest in Australia's last boom city? Why not invest in the new boom city? There is a sense that Adelaide is on the cusp of a real economic revitalisation driven by the resources industry, by the defence industry, but also by some of the strengths of the Adelaide and its regional economy.
Actually, there was a spat played out in one of the Sydney papers over the last week between, I think, a planner who used to live in Adelaide only briefly for a couple of years and Alexander Downer. And it was very amusing. I don't know if it really helped the city. It occurs to me that if you look at some of the cities rated highly on this issue around the world, some of them have very distinct identities. Places, two places in Spain, actually, Bilbao and Barcelona, they're both language hubs. They both have a very distinct regional identity. We don't have anything like that here.
I think you're right about identity. The evidence suggests, the evidence from a number of European regions and other parts of the world, that cities and regions, if they seek to develop, certainly through a strategy rather than through good fortune or good luck, they work much better where they've both got good leadership and a sense of who they are and where they're going. And I think the establishment of the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao enabled that city to develop a new identity based on its strong leadership, its sense of direction, and its character as a centre of the arts. So it was a brilliant branding of the city in the international sphere. The Australian cities don't have quite that sort of iconic image. I mean, in terms of architecture, for instance, we've got very few iconic buildings. Adelaide certainly doesn't. Perhaps the Opera House in Sydney is one of them. But we tend to have cities that have numerous strengths. For instance, Adelaide is extremely competitive in terms of the general business competitive measures. Most of the Australian cities are in the very top rank of the quality of life indices around the world.
Mm.
But these are more general characteristics, and I think you're right. We struggle to develop brands that are really very crystal clear and decisive.
You can't
Sydney's
just
possibly the exception.
You can't just invent it, can you? I mean, it has to come organically. As I said, Bilbao, it's the centre of Basque language and culture. Mm. Barcelona has the Catalan. You hear Catalan more than you hear Spanish in Barcelona. Mm. And you can't sort of decree that we will have this iconic differentness to build a brand.
Mm. No, you can't. And there's always been a distinctiveness about Australian cities, but it's a more nuanced distinctiveness. And for instance, Adelaide's always been a rival with Melbourne in terms of the football and in terms of various other things. But internationally, that's not really a strong impression that other people might see. We haven't got a really strong identity to our cities. And I agree, it needs to come out of the soil of the city, I guess. Adelaide, of course, has had an identity as an art city and trades a bit on that. But it's a very competitive environment.
Well, it seems to me that all the planners and politicians can do is try to get the fundamentals in place. And then you need luck and you need other things to happen, really.
Yes, and you need passion, I think. I think a lot of the successful cities have had passionate leaders, often only small group of people, often an informal grouping, might include government and other people, but people with some sort of vision that they want to pursue and build on. And I think that's been proved to be essential to the reinvigoration of regions that are competing in a very competitive global economy.
Dean, it's clearly something that's going to continue forever, essentially. That's where we'll leave it today. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you, Richard.
Professor Dean Forbes is an urban policy researcher and Deputy Vice-Chancellor at Flinders University. You're on ABC Radio National with me, Richard Addy. This is Life Matters. We've just been talking about cities, but this week's Meet the Listener guest lives in a country town where there's never a dull moment. That's right after this track called Home by the Wilkinsons.
These days I wake up in some place new, where my old guitar's the only familiar face in this room. And if I close my eyes, I don't have to think real hard. I can almost see me standing in my old backyard. There's no place like home.
This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Richard Addy with you. Now we're heading to Panola in southeastern South Australia to meet a listener in both name and nature. Fiona Listener jumped ship from Adelaide 4 years ago, but she's found moving to the country hasn't meant moving to the quiet life. Fiona joins me now. Welcome to Life Matters.
Good morning, Richard.
What took you to Panola?
It was a combination of both my husband's work, he's a winemaker, and also me gaining a job with the South Australian Tourism Commission.
Right, okay. Well, tell me about Panola. Where is it?
We're about 390 kilometres southeast of Adelaide, and we like to say we're sort of halfway between Melbourne and Adelaide on the Redoc Highway.
Right. Is that actually true, though, or is that just something you say?
It's pretty close. It's probably about 60 kilometres either way, right. Between both, yes.
And it's Coonawarra, I'm thinking?
You are indeed. We're, I guess when we talk about Panola, we always talk about Coonawarra. Coonawarra is 10 kilometres north of Panola, so it's the Panola and Coonawarra district.
And Limestone Coast region, I'm thinking, which I've read about. It's very beautiful. How many people are living there?
In Panola itself, there's only 1,500, and within the district with Coonawarra and the surrounds, there's approximately 3,500. So it's a small community, but we're only 50 kilometres north of Mount Gambier as well. So we have that regional city just, with easy drive away, really.
And because I'm a good Catholic boy, I happen to know that a very famous Australian Catholic is from or at least began to make her name in the area.
She did indeed. Mary MacKillop, actually, with Father Julian Tennyson Woods, founded the Sisters of St. Joseph in Panola. So that's, and she was beatified, of course, in 1995. So we have a fantastic interpretive centre that was opened 3 years later. So, yes, we're very proud of our history and Mary MacKillop and her connections to the region.
There's an advertising campaign running in Sydney at the moment to try and entice people to relocate to Adelaide. Now, you went from Adelaide to a small town. How did you find the transition?
Look, the first winter, I turned the winter of my discontent because I moved in winter, which probably isn't the best time of year to move to a slightly colder climate, and it felt like it rained every single day, and it was me, the cat, and satellite television for that first couple of months. So,
where was your husband?
My husband was working over on the coast, on the Limestone Coast, over in the Mount Benson wine region. So he was an hour and a half away.
So you moved because of your husband's job, but you didn't actually live together?
No. Strangely enough, it took 2 years for us to actually then live together permanently. So the joys of the wine industry, I must say.
Yeah.
So, yes, no, but look, it was very hard in the beginning, but I through my job with tourism, I actually did get to meet an awful lot of people and got invited to a lot of things, and I quickly learnt to say yes to things more than no, so that I got to meet new people and get out and about a bit more.
I would imagine a little wine, and it would be all about wine, really, in your area. would go a long way to meeting new friends.
It does help, I must say. And there's a very strong community feel here around the wine industry, and we have a full calendar of events. It's I often actually say now I'm much more busy and social living here than I ever was in the city, where you sort of tended to go home from work and not do much else, whereas here we still do things during the week and go out for dinner and all sorts of bits and pieces. And then there are festivals and events on throughout the year, so there's a whole calendar, you know, whether it be the middle of winter or, you know, the heat of January. We have our biggest racing meeting in January, so there's always something to see and do here.
You're doing your spiel now, Fiona, I can tell. Now, what you said something I found very interesting before, which I think was good advice, about when you're moving into a new community, your advice, you got into the habit of saying yes rather than no.
I did. And I think that's ended me up on a few committees as well through saying yes. I'm learning to say no now. It's a case of, even when you don't feel like it, just make the effort, because you never know who you're going to meet. And we've made some absolutely wonderful friends here who make life always very interesting. And, you know, It can be really hard, but you just have to put yourself out there a bit more, I think, than in the city, because people are very open and do like to invite new people along to things, because they're just as interested in you as you are, you know, as you are in them. So, you know, they want to know who that person's moved in next door. They won't leave you alone until they do.
On Life Matters, meet the listener guest this week is Fiona Listener, who's moved from the city to the country and is now busier than ever from the sound of things. Now, You've had this past weekend a bit of a big event.
We have indeed. We've had the Panola Coonawarra Arts Festival on this just past weekend, and as you can hear from my voice, I may have done a bit of talking and running around for it. The festival's 17 years old, so it's a really interesting festival in that we try and bring acts from interstate and all over Australia to the community, so the community can actually experience that arts experience without having to go anywhere. So we have exhibitions in cellar doors and workshops and writers' workshops and painting workshops and food workshops and all sorts of things. So it's a real hands-on thing, and it runs for 3 nights and 3 days, and it turns into a bit of crazy, actually, but it was absolutely fantastic on the weekend.
You'll need to lie down in a darkened room.
I almost felt like that yesterday morning, I must say.
I would imagine this kind of... We talk regularly on Life Matters with V-Track Tiva about the volunteering life. I would imagine volunteers would have been key to getting this thing going.
They are. The committee's actually a whole group of volunteers. We sort of range in age from 25 to... I won't give our oldest member away, but her age away, but she's in her 70s, so we've got the whole gamut of age on the committee, and they are all volunteers, and they put in so much time and effort. We're a bit scared to add up actually how many hours we all put in, but it's all volunteer, and grants, you know, even to writing of grants for to get funds for the festival. So without the volunteers, it just wouldn't happen.
And by your decision to say yes to things rather than no, you've become a kind of senior member of the group and a really part of the town now.
I have. I ended up by president of the committee by default when one of our committee members moved away, and I wasn't sure about it, and I wasn't quite sure what I'd bitten off more than I could chew, but it's turned out to be a wonderful experience, and it is, and you really do become part of the community. Everybody knows your name and your phone number, and you get called for all manner of things. But look, it's given me so much more than I could ever imagine in so many different ways.
You'll need to go on holiday to Adelaide.
I would like that. That would be nice. Might have some time to catch up with my family and friends in Adelaide.
Well, thank you very much, Fiona, for joining us today.
Thank you.
And that was this week's Meet the Listener, Fiona Listener, the city girl who now wouldn't trade the country for anything. Now, I've just got a bit of time for a couple of your responses. Remember, more of your letters and some calls tomorrow. On Wednesday's big response, big reaction to the discussion we had yesterday on pensions. I've got one here from Selkie. I was surprised that this discussion completely ignored the plight of disability pensioners who are in the same financial situation as aged pensioners, failing even to give them a mention. It seems strange to me. We have talked about disability pensioners before on the show, but I take your point, Selkie. And this one from Helen. absolutely pensioners need more, especially those living on their own. My dad always buys and eats frugally, but still his expenditure is $10 a week more than his income. He lives in a very modest unit in a church-run retirement village where the costs have escalated way beyond the CPI since he moved in 4 years ago. We live on the far north coast of New South Wales. I can only find casual work, so I'm really struggling to subsidise my dad. I do so by making him soup and stews to put in his freezer and thereby save a couple of dollars on his fairly meagre food bill. At least I know the food going into his freezer is of excellent quality, as I grow it all myself. We will definitely have more on that tomorrow. I would not at all be surprised to find out. Now, I've got one here too from Kelvin. Not only is the pension below the poverty line, but any attempt to improve oneself's heavily penalised. Example, a politician gets immediate pension on leaving Parliament and can then earn huge amounts and still have his or her pension fully indexed, etc. We are restricted to, I think, about $125 a fortnight max. No wonder some do lawns for cash, and I salute them. When I worked and was invited into a pension scheme and then left, I lost just about everything and received, I think, an interest rate of 4% on any monies I may have paid into that fund. Meanwhile, the bank interest rates paid on deposits at that time were 12 to 15%. Politicians only have themselves to blame for our current position, having neglected the matter for so long. Yet we're expected to once again pay for their mistakes. We all note that they certainly never neglected themselves over the same period. Naturally, I could go on forever with our grievances. Yes. Well, definitely more on this tomorrow. Now, coming up next on ABC Radio National, right after the news, is The Book Show. And today, Luke Davies.
We have Luke Davies talking about his new novel, which is based on the demise of Howard Hughes, and also Scottish novelist and essayist Alison Kennedy, A.L. Kennedy, on why she likes to write in the dark, or why she likes to work overnight when all of us are sleeping.
I hope she can see what she's doing.
I think she's got a very small torch.
Small torches. And Luke Davies, author of the new book, The God of Speed, with Ramona, right after the news on ABC Radio National. Now, tomorrow on the show, a challenge to all well-intentioned, devoted parents. Quit the hyper-parenting. Slow down. My guest will be Carl Honoré. You might remember him as the author of In Praise of Slow. It all started for him at the parent-teacher night. He realised he was hyper-parenting and had to slow down. Join me for that tomorrow.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.